Okay, so my name is Caitlin Allen, and I'm here interviewing Kim O'Donnell.
Mm-hmm.
So, Kim, can you tell us what it was like growing up in Fort Lauderdale, Florida?
Oh, goodness. Very different from growing up in Floyd, for sure. Florida, I mean, just geographically, it's very different. It's densely populated, so there are a lot of people, you know, neighbors right next to you. The population density was one of the biggest differences between the two places. And in the town that I grew up, it was a beach town, so pretty loosey-goosey in a lot of ways. A lot of drug use, kids just, yeah, really different. I hadn't even thought about Florida. I thought we were going to talk about Virginia. That's why I'm like, oh. You know, I had a very, I actually had a very difficult high school experience in both places. I attended high schools in both places.
Mm-hmm.
But growing up in Florida as a younger child, you know, you can be outside all the time. In those days, you know, parents were not as concerned about someone stealing you or, you know, and so I was on my bike outside all the time. And we had local, someone from our local community rec program would come to us in our neighborhood, and we'd play football, just have outdoor games and stuff. I was pretty much outside my whole childhood, really.
Wow. So then what was it like for you transitioning to Floyd?
It was wonderful because the Floyd community was much tighter and closer. When you're involved in athletics, you have a built-in community. And so I started actually with becoming a real athlete in the sense of organized sports in Floyd in the eighth grade. And I loved that. I loved that sense of camaraderie. And so I had some really good, close relationships with people in Floyd. Academically, it was really different, I have to say. The academics at Floyd County High School were not great. And the academics at the school that I went to in Florida were better. It's a bigger school, and they had advanced placement classes. And in the 70s, Floyd didn't have any of that. So a stronger sense of community in Virginia and in Floyd County High School, but the academics weren't as good.
So now, what was it like? You went to an all-girls college in Virginia.
I did.
And what was that like?
Unbelievably fantastic. I hadn't intended to do that, actually. My plan was to attend the University of Virginia on a basketball scholarship. Mm-hmm. And I was actually a very good basketball player and had been recruited by them. And I was still an out-of-state student. Again, I moved back and forth from Virginia to Florida during my high school years for reasons we may talk about or we may not. But so I ended up, I had a motorcycle accident the summer of before my senior year in high school, and it completely derailed any athletic career I had. And I had put all of my hopes in the University of Virginia and would have gone there had I not had that accident. But when that happened, they were no longer interested, of course. And I was an out-of-state student. I didn't have priority status as an athlete, and I didn't get in. So I was completely surprised because I had great grades, but I don't standardize tests. I didn't standardize tests well. And so at about the same time, the University of Virginia said no to me. Mary Baldwin College, believe it or not, was in Florida recruiting. And I went there sight unseen. And I loved it. For me, because I felt sort of out of place anyway as a lesbian, I never considered a women's college, but it was a gift to me because when it's all women, the women are the ones who have to be leaders. They're the ones who have to take ownership of what's happening on campus, and there was no competition with guys, which was really good for me because I really needed that spark of encouragement. And in terms of my own sexuality, I think I would have felt very much like an outsider if I had gone to a coeducational school at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Totally different for me now in my life. But at that time, I just would have really felt like I didn't belong.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so then you went to University of Richmond after
mm-hmm.
Mary Baldwin
mm-hmm.
for your master's. And so
mm-hmm. for my law degree.
Yes, for your law degree. So mm-hmm. was that... different from Mary Baldwin?
Oh, yeah. Very different. I hated it. And it wasn't because it was co-educational. That was my first opportunity. I mean, that, aside from high school, it was my first co-educational experience. And that part of it was fine. It was just an extremely competitive atmosphere, and I didn't like it. I became a lawyer because I wanted to help people, or at least I went to law school with that idea that I wanted to help people. I didn't know how, and nothing about law school was about helping people. It's really kind of creating that litigious brain of, you know, you can argue both sides, and it was just really, really challenging, humiliating, actually, in some respects, because it was so competitive, and I didn't like it at all. I had a pretty significant crisis of identity, like, why did I do this? This is not what I had in mind at all. The school itself was lovely and made some great friends and really good people, but I didn't like the academic atmosphere at all.
So, what was it like? You were the first openly gay judge in Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like for you?
It was challenging, actually, in the beginning. I had been openly gay my whole career, and when I decided, I was very young when I decided to try to become a judge, and I remember sitting in my office, kind of closing the doors and thinking, okay. I was open, but not, I just didn't talk about my life. I didn't hide it, but, you know, everybody's talking about what they did for the weekend. You just don't really participate because you're not really wanting to use gender. So, you know, people closest to me knew. It wasn't like it was a secret. I just didn't talk about it. And when I decided that I was going to try to become a judge, I had the awareness that it could prevent me from doing what I wanted to do. And I didn't know whether it would be well known or whatever. And I was scared, actually. And I went through the process the first time, and I was only 30. I wasn't selected to become a judge. And after it was, and it had never come up. No one asked me, wasn't mentioned. And after it was over, I was relieved. And a friend of mine who was working for a very prominent senator at the time, I saw after the whole process, and I said, Joyce, you know, I'm so relieved, you know, it didn't come up. And she said, it absolutely did come up.
Wow.
And I was like, okay, all right. It was discussed. It was a matter of, you know, it was on the table with everybody who was considering your appointment, and but it wasn't the obstacle that kept you from becoming a judge. So I felt really gratified by that, so it didn't prevent me from becoming a judge. Sometimes you have to go through the process a number of times before you're selected, and I was selected at 34, there were no openly gay judges, and I was at a judicial training shortly after I became a judge, and they were doing, believe it or not, all of the judges in Virginia at my level, which is the general district court level, hundreds of us gathered together for a conference, which is required every year. And the Supreme Court, who trains all the judges, wanted to focus on diversity education. And it's a hard thing to do. Most of the judges at that time were white men.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were in this big, huge room with a group of grown-up people playing diversity bingo. Have you ever done that? You know what it is? So you have a card, and it's like a bingo card, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in each of the squares, it says, I've been on public assistance, I'm gay or lesbian, I drive a red truck. I mean, all of these different identifiers in this thing, and the goal was to walk around the room and cross and get bingo. And so one of the things was, I'm gay. And it was the first time I had publicly, you know, said to someone, yeah, you know, because it was, I mean, the opportunities really weren't there very often. And I was a little nervous, There's nobody said anything, and that's the thing about being in the South. People don't say much to your face. They're going to be polite and respectful. But afterwards, a very dear friend of mine who was a staff person who did all the training for judges, I was telling her the story, and really, really unfortunately, her reaction was, "Oh my God, you didn't really do that." Instead of, "Way to go, I'm so glad that you took that step." She was really afraid for me. I took my partners with me to all the judicial conferences. I mean, I didn't keep people at home and out of sight, but nobody really talked about it.
Mm-hmm.
And mostly it was just lonely because there weren't, you know, my colleagues were terrific. I worked in Richmond, some of the bench, you know, there were five of us there are four now, but there were five of us on the bench. So I had people that I worked with who were supportive. But it wasn't, again, it just wasn't something that, you know, there wasn't anybody else. There was not a single other openly gay judge in Virginia that I could even talk to. So, you know, and the loneliness, frankly, of being in, people don't think about this, it's really a lonely job, actually, because so much of what you do is in isolation by yourself. You're making decisions alone. But worse than, the hardest, most isolating piece was not just being a lesbian and having no other compatriots, but was really being a woman in a man's arena. And it was completely a man's arena then. And it just didn't resonate with me in that way. So,
wow.
Long answer to your question.
So when you came into awareness of your sexuality, you said, mm-hmm, it was still considered a mental disease. And
it was.
So what was your family and, did you tell friends about this? What was their reaction?
You know, it's really interesting. I had a very unusual experience of coming out. I never did. I think there's only one person in my life who was a male judge that was a colleague of mine who had a crush on me. And I knew I had to tell him. I just had to say, okay, you know, it's this. But other than that, I don't think I ever had that experience. My situation was really different and traumatic in different ways. So I didn't even know that I was a lesbian. I didn't even know what the word meant. And my first relationship, and it's not even the right word, but my first experience with a woman was actually with a teacher. It was really fucked up. I mean, not to mince words, but whatever, that's just the truth. It was really fucked up. And this was in Floyd County, not my instigation at all. So that happened in the 10th, when I was in the 10th grade, with a teacher there, a woman teacher. And my mother found out about it. And removed me from Floyd County High School, and that's why we went back to Florida. So my first even thought about it came when my mother intercepted some communication between me and this teacher who was stupid enough to send mail to my home, and confronted me and said, you know, "Are you a lesbian?" And I was like, "I have no idea." Never even heard the word. Don't like it to this day, to tell you the truth. Because of that experience of, it didn't, I knew I really wanted to say no. It wasn't a yes that you wanted to give, and I just couldn't even respond. And so it was traumatic, really traumatic. And my parents, you know, my mother was freaked out. She had no idea what to do. And so I was sent to a psychiatrist who, you know, was doing his job because it was, you know, mental illness. And I didn't go very often. It just wasn't many times. It was not helpful to me. I'm very fortunate. I think I'm one of the few people that I know who for whatever reason, I personally didn't have guilt and shame about it. I knew the rest of the world was uncomfortable. I knew my parents were ashamed. But I never felt like something was wrong with me. I just knew where I could talk about it and where I couldn't. But then I came back to Floyd County High School, and was, I still at this, you know, 40 years later, I don't have the words to really accurately say what it was. They weren't relationships. but then I had I was molested, accosted, I don't know, by another teacher, another female teacher. So twice that happened to me. And was immediately moved from Floyd County High School then. So there was a lot of really weird stuff around it. And, you know, like I said, I didn't come out. My mother told me, and I knew that was true. And it took me a lot of years, probably being in a safe college environment. And women's schools don't have probably any more lesbians than anybody else, but we had some, and at least I felt like, you know, I wasn't completely alone. But it was strange. Traumatic. Very difficult. Wow. And not many people know the story, you know, so part of... For me, you know, there was so much isolation because I couldn't tell anybody. I mean, who do you tell about that, right? And so the only hesitancy I had, I almost didn't put my name. And I thought, I've carried the secret, you know, for long enough. What if someone reads this and knows who these people were, you know? In this day and age, they would have gone to jail. I don't need to protect them. You know, I don't need to name the names, but I don't need to protect them either. So, yeah, different. But it saved me from having to have that, you know, Mom, Dad, guess what? Didn't have to do that.
Wow. That's crazy. So
it is crazy. What is in the water in Floyd County? I'm serious. It's like, really? But at that age, the thing that screws you up is, you know, and this is the thing about power dynamics and relationships that are out of balance like that, especially at that age, you know, your formative early, you know, experiences with sexuality. But it really messes up and I didn't even realize how much it messed me up, because you have this sense that you're special, right? You know, your teacher likes you, and there's this whole weird thing that happens, and there's nothing about it that's normal or right. But there were, you know, part of my experience was that I had nobody to talk to. My parents were not sympathetic. They were not. My mother just didn't have the capacity emotionally to comfort me, and so there was nobody who said, you know, wow, this sucks, man. This is not your fault. You know, this is not the way it's supposed to be. This is not the way everybody is. And that, you know, if I had had an intervention, a caring parent who was able to, maybe at a different time, support me, it might have been different. It might not have messed up my interpersonal relationships so much. But, you know, that's the way it was.
So you said that you went between Floyd and Florida.
I did.
A lot. Did you notice a difference? Like, was there a dichotomy between the two places?
In what ways? And you mean in terms of the sexuality or the acceptance or the...
I'd say sort of a little bit of both, like the acceptance and sexuality. Like, would you say that there was a difference between the two, or was it really just...
No, not so much. I mean, you know, at that time, it was just a different time, you know. Nobody talked about, you know, homosexuality, you know... I didn't even know really what it was. And, you know, how did you find people who were like you? At that time, you know, I think a lot of girls, I was certainly very boyish and tomboyish. You know, it was so confusing that you felt, well, maybe, you know, I'm more comfortable dressing in a certain way. And so you identified people by their girls who were sort of more masculine. You thought, oh, maybe she's like me. But there really wasn't much acceptance for it at all. And because my mother was aware, had sort of an antenna on, I mean, every friendship that I had was sort of really scrutinized. And one of my best friends in high school in Florida, who is also also a lesbian, didn't have a relationship with her, but we were just really good friends. You know, we were forbidden to, when my mother found out that we were friends, we were actually forbidden to have any contact at our high school. Our teachers would watch. I mean, you know, that didn't happen in Floyd, but, you know, there I was accosted by two teachers. I mean, you know, it wasn't something that anybody discussed or talked about. It was very underground, you know. When I was in high school, in fact, you know, it was older people that we kind of connected with. So the teachers, you know, Floyd was the same way. But in Florida, you know, you just kind of found each other, and there were older people who would tell you kind of where to go, and there were gay bars that never, you know, checked IDs, where you could just go, and, you know, they were seedy, shady, dark places, but at least you weren't alone. So both places, you know, there wasn't the same kind of culture here, you know, in Florida, Fort Lauderdale, Florida, there's, you know, there were a number of gay bars there, mostly, you know, the nicer ones always were for men. So you had access to more things outside the mainstream than you did in Floyd. In Floyd, you know, and they still don't talk about it. Well, Jim's making them talk about it. But it's not something they're comfortable with even today.
So, I know that you're getting married soon.
I am.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
So in 2015, the marriage equality decision was reached by the Supreme Court.
And yeah.
A huge win for gay rights. And so what was your reaction to this?
Shock. Shock. Never expected it to happen in my lifetime. And then it was interesting. You know, I was so used to not thinking of it as a possibility. It wasn't even in my radar screen. I assumed, because we couldn't do it, that there were a lot of benefits to it, you know. And when it became possible for us to get married, my partner Anita and I have been together for 10 years, I thought it would be an automatic, like, of course we'll do this. There's no question about us being committed and whatever. And, you know, it turned into this really different kind of conversation of, okay, what are the pros and cons? Just because we can doesn't mean we should. And I realized that, you know, there are some negatives to it. And it turned into more of a financial conversation, which I really hated. I did. I was like, this is not a financial decision. And, you know, so it was wonderful, you know. I mean, everybody should have the right to do it. It doesn't mean that everybody will want to or everybody should. I mean, marriage, all people are getting married less, I think. But I've also seen how different it is. I mean, it's a different kind of commitment, and it feels really different to me. So I'm thrilled that people have the choice, you know, and really excited, really excited.
And so now you're currently living in Floyd,
mm-hmm.
and one of our other interview and partners is mm-hmm. Jim Best.
Yep.
So he's working to
yep.
kind of bring the conversation out in Floyd about LGBTQ plus relationships.
Yeah.
So what do you think of that whole movement in Floyd? Do you think...
Yeah, I think it's amazing. Jim is carrying on work, actually, that other people started. And so when I came to Floyd, I had some fear about coming back. You know, I came back to care for my mother in 2007. I quit my job, came home to care for her. And most of my people in Richmond were like, what are you doing? Are you kidding? I had a vibrant, you know, group of friends and gay and lesbian people in Richmond. Most of my friends there, my close friends, were women. And they thought I was insane to go to this, you know, place where typically you would think there's not much acceptance. And I had fear of coming back and who I would see. There was a lot of healing for me to do, you know, the things that I had dealt with as a kid. And very shortly after coming back, maybe within a year, there was a group of my friends, not Jim, who wanted to start a PFLAG chapter. And so we started the PFLAG chapter. It was really a woman at the high school named Diane Jackson who started the first diversity club at Floyd County. I think it was the first diversity club at Floyd County High School. And she was really one of the main people in starting the PFLAG group And it was astounding to me to think that, you know, this was happening in Floyd. And to be honest with you, because my life has changed so much since then, I mean, I went from, you know, sort of cautiously being open to being wide open by the time I left Richmond. You know, I had, for a number of years, I had a partner who was very open and had a child. And that was really, that was in the 90s for me. And when I entered into that relationship, it was the first, my first experience with having a child in my family, and it changed everything for me. She was very proud and happy and very open, telling everybody how great it was that her mom was in a relationship with me, and I was like, oh my God. And there was no way she was going to see anything but 100%. That's great. Fantastic. And it changed my life. That's when everything became completely open for me, and I began to see how critical it was that there'd be people who'd be willing to do that. So we would have neighbors into our house for monthly potlucks, and these were older women who didn't think they ever knew a gay person. And we were very open, and I think it really changed how they viewed things. When I came to Floyd, you know, I have to say, you know, the movement has not been my passion. It's not been my passion. Being open and demonstrating in the way I live my life, you know, this is what a gay person looks like, take it or leave it. When that PFLAG group started, there really wasn't anybody in that initial group that felt a calling like Jim does, a calling to be visible and vocal. I'd been there, done that. I was very open when I came to Floyd. You know, every person I, you know, every place I went, you know, this is who I am. This is my partner, Anita, still lives in Richmond. And, you know, I just didn't feel moved to be an advocate in that way. And so PFLAG was about to fold in Floyd until Jim came along. And he has taken it to another level. I mean, he's fearless. He's fearless in his, and he's just the right messenger. You know, right, wrong, or indifferent, he's got the right package. You know, he grew up in a Mormon, as a Mormon, he probably told you, he's graceful, he's attractive, he's articulate, he's intelligent, he's a great conversationalist, and he's just been the right person to carry the message, and I'm really grateful to him, because it's courageous of him. You know, he's a part of the Quaker meeting that I attend, and Quakers do things in a very beautiful way, but Jim was feeling like he had a leading. This is not just, I mean, it's a spiritual thing for him, a leading to be working first with religious communities in Floyd because of wanting to educate them, open their minds to, because of his real deep concern for kids. And so our meeting is supporting that leading, and so we have a support group actually for Jim, and I'm a part of that. And one of the things we commit to is, you know, offering companionship and being with him as he does his mission. And I went to him to a Seventh-day Adventist church in Floyd, and I was just blown away at how he's able to present himself and connect and finding commonality and common ground. He's really changing the world there. It's not my passion and mission, you know. My partner was married to a man for many, many years. Being with a woman was new for her. She really wanted, you know, lesbian friends. Like, I don't care anymore. You know, most of my friends now are heterosexuals just because that's who's there and who I connect with. You know, fortunately for me, the world has changed so much that I don't segment it in that way anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just, I can be myself with anybody, and that's all that matters to me. You know, my closest long-term friends are gay women, but so the PFLAG, I stepped away from PFLAG. I support completely what he's doing. I admire and respect him so much, but I really think that each of us should do what really moves us and speaks to us. You know, not that we don't support a lot of things, and that's been Jim's calling, and it's phenomenal what he's doing. You know, I wish that there had been someone like Jim. You know, for me, that I could have seen some example of somebody present for me. I'd be, you know, happy to be in that role, you know, somehow at the high school. I've offered to talk to the diversity club or to be there, just to, you know, for the kids to see. There are all kinds of ways of living in the world, and you can have a great life. So, again, a long answer to your question, but
no, that's okay.
Do you think that Floyd is an anomaly in the Southwest Virginia area?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do. I don't know that much about the other communities in Southwest Virginia like I do Floyd. But when I came back and was working as a retired judge, I did sit in other places, and it is unique. You know, for whatever reason, Floyd has attracted since the 70s, you know, an alternative community that historically embraces everything. I mean, live and let live, whatever turns you on, right? As long as you're not hurting somebody. And so there's a strong component of that in Floyd. A lot of people have come into the county because it's got that energy. So there are more new people in Floyd who are liberal and accepting, welcoming, and I think that's an advantage for us. You know, it's not to say that there still isn't old Floyd, but that everybody in the county is supportive of PFLAG, because they're not, but it's much more welcoming than I would have ever imagined.
And so I guess, what would you say was the most defining moment for you? Like, if you could look back on, you know, your whole life and find one moment to pull and, you know, sort of explain to somebody who is struggling with their sexuality now, what would you take away from that defining moment?
In terms of the totality of my acceptance of myself and really stepping out into the world completely free, that didn't happen for me until my 40s. And when I made that transition from quietly being who I was to really openly being who I was, my whole life changed. And it was, you know, you don't recognize how much you're holding back, how much you're hiding, until you are just willing to fully be yourself. And my gratitude to people who've had the courage to do that, and they're public figures in our life because they're the most visible, who have really changed the world. Ellen DeGeneres has changed the world by being courageous enough, putting her entire career on the line by being able to say, you know, this is who I am. And so that changed for me, because I saw how how much differently I felt in the world. You know, I didn't hold back anything. You know, I didn't screen or filter. That's probably not the right place to talk about my partner here. And you know, even though I didn't have the shame about myself, and I know there are plenty of people who do. They have religious messages in their head that they're not worthy, that they're sinners, they're condemned, they're, you know, all of the messages that come from different families and from different religions, is that, you know, the sooner that you can, whatever work it takes for you to be okay with yourself and to have the courage and willingness, no matter where you have to do it, go somewhere, move somewhere where you can feel free enough to authentically be yourself, do it. Because it really did change my life, and it took me a long time. The world's different now. You know, it's easier in some ways, and still very, very difficult for individuals. The world is a lot better, but doesn't change the fact that individual families are still, can be very punishing and dismissive, and, you know, for too many people in the world, it's still, you know, there's still a lot they have to lose by just being who they are. But the sooner you can get to that point, you know, the more happiness that you're going to have individually, I think.
Yeah. And so, you know, you obviously flip-flop between Floyd and Florida. And
used to,
Yes, you used to. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, now you're situated sort of in Floyd. And so,
definitely.
when you first came into your sexuality, you know, you said that your mother was kind of, she knew, but she was kind of,
she wasn't accepting.
Yes, wasn't very accepting of
it. In any way.
And so how would you say for parents now, especially living in southwestern Virginia, which is sort of a more conservative area, how would you, what advice would you give for them to deal with their children's sexuality? You know, how would you?
Yeah. You know, my parents grew to be very accepting. And they educated themselves, and they had a lot of obstacles against them at that time because all the literature was, much of the literature was, you know, very scary for them. So I'm grateful that my parents eventually did their homework and came to accept and love me for who I was. You know, as a parent, it's difficult for me. It's difficult for me. I haven't given birth to any children, but I have stepchildren. It's difficult for me to understand why a parent would reject their kid. And most typically, I know this was true for my mother before she knew. When I was a kid, you know, I was boyish, I was most comfortable that way, and I think she was embarrassed. It was about her, it wasn't about me. It was about her own discomfort with having a kid who didn't conform to sort of the norm or didn't turn out the way she wanted me to. And so, you know, for parents who are dealing with any kind of kid who's just, you know, not the mainstream, not doing what everybody else does, it's just kind of, I think you have to have the courage to look at your own self and look at what's really going on here, you know, and have the willingness to do that work yourself and love your kid. The world is scary enough, you know. When your family supports and loves you, you have so much more of a solid foundation to stand on when you go out into the world. The world can be difficult for anybody who's different. You know, get help. You know, there's plenty of really great resources out there now. If you can't do it on your own, talk to someone else. Find an organization where you can talk to parents who are going through the same thing. You know, support yourself. It's lonely for parents too, you know.
So, all right, so, I guess.
It sounds like it's an exhausting process to be gay in just general.
You know, not anymore.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's not anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I don't even think about it anymore,
mm-hmm.
really. I think that's what I was trying to say earlier about, you know, I know that we tend to stick together before, you know, and that in gatherings so you could be comfortable, be yourself, you can touch your partner because there are other people who are gay or lesbian in the room. And I really don't even think about it anymore. You know, I have such a good community in Floyd, and you choose your friends, right? You're not going to hang out with people who aren't going to welcome you. And I just don't think about it as much anymore. You know, it's not that it's, you know, so this is a really silly thing, but it's not like it's completely gone. You know, I don't think gay and lesbian people should just do what heterosexuals have been doing forever because heterosexuals have been doing it forever. And marriage is one of those things. But, you know, but there are sort things that happen, right? And when you get married, you typically, not typically, but sometimes there's an announcement in the paper, right? Your picture's there, and everybody's like, oh, that's good. And I, you know, was thinking about that recently. We're older, which is makes it a little different, but and I'm probably not going to do that in the Floyd County paper. You know, have some listing of things there. So there's, you know, little remnants of things where, you know, probably not going to do that in Floyd County. I don't even know if I do it in Richmond, really. But it's just not so much an issue for me anymore. And I think it's so refreshing that it's not the focus. My life doesn't revolve around, you know, finding places where I can go, where my partner and I can be safe. You know, all of the websites that talk about, okay, places that are, you know, where gay and lesbian people can travel. And, you know, I've traveled all over the world. You know, there's just not a lot of that to worry about anymore. We go where we want to go, not because it's gay friendly. I mean, and that was a focus. You know, when we would travel, or my friends and I would travel, in the 80s, you know, we would look for, you know, gay-friendly places to go. Oh, let's go to Key West and stay at a gay B&B, you know. It's just not so much of an issue anymore. And, you know, I think that will become less and less the case because of your generation and kids coming after you. It's just, my stepdaughter's 33. It just wasn't an issue for her and her friends. The whole gender conversation is beyond me now. We talk about, you know, I have a cousin who's a lesbian who's 10 years younger than me, and there's all this, you know, gender language. I don't understand, you know, I'm open to it. You know, the whole transgender movement. There's some transgender people in Floyd. You know, I'm learning. It's kind of the next terrain for me, you know. How do you respectfully have a conversation without using pronouns, and what are people's preferences, and, you know, it's uncomfortable just because I don't want to offend anyone, but, you know, it's certainly, throughout my life has been a source of sadness, you know, mostly because, you know, you're just not included, you know, and because of my age and the partners that I had. I mean, I had a partner for 10 years in my 30s who, wonderful woman, very scared of telling her family. And so she never did the entire time we were together. And, you know, they're taking family pictures at weddings, and you know, we've been together for 8 years, and, you know, nobody's saying Kim should be in the picture. I mean, that kind of subtle exclusion is really hard, really, really hard. And that doesn't happen anymore. You know, so many of us have the pain of that it's just a part of your life. It's what you experience, and you're grateful that it's not that way anymore, and you learn to make choices that keep that from happening. I couldn't be in relationship with someone who wasn't willing to be 100% wide open. I'm not willing to do that anymore. But not to say that I don't have respect and understanding why other people make those very hard choices. And I'm fortunate in this sense in my life now. My mother was a very forbidding figure in my life, very critical, very harsh. And I spent most of my life worried about whether what I was doing was going to be okay with her, whatever, and she's dead. And I don't mean to sound insensitive when I say that. But there's nobody in the world anymore I care about what their feelings are in the way that it would influence me negatively, you know? I mean, I'm who I am. I'm sensitive and kind to other people. It's not that, you know, but that voice of, uh-oh, what's she going to say if I do this? Gone. It's completely gone. It's very liberating. So, you know, not everybody has that experience, obviously, I'm grateful to say. But, you know, and it's not that the work is over by any stretch. You know, there, and especially in Southwest Virginia, in pockets that are not Floyd County, kids are suffering. There's so much meanness in the world, you know? I mean, really, look at what kids do to each other, and it feels to me like that's really different from when I was in high school. That was certainly very different, but I didn't get bullied, called names and things like that in the same way I think a lot of kids do.
Do you think because there is more awareness now that they're being bullied, or because like when you were in high school and elementary school there wasn't much going on?
Yeah. Maybe, mm-hmm. maybe because things are more open and there's more an awareness of this is the name I can call you. We didn't even know then, right? And so that might be the case. And more kids are, you know, having the courage to kind of be who they are. And, you know, you can have a supportive home environment. I know some kids in Floyd who have supportive families, and the school environment is just harsh. And a number of them have had to homeschool their kids. They're like, I'm just not doing it. I'm not putting my kid through this. And I really blame the institution for that. You know, there's, for me as an adult, around any issue, It would be incomprehensible to me to allow an environment like that to exist, where the adults are not in charge and saying, you know, this is really not okay, and creating the safe space, and that's not happening. And it's because of, you know, people's own biases and prejudices that are still there, and, you know, that's how they feel. That's how the adults feel, and they're not reining in the kids. And You know, someone like Jim has the right sort of intolerance for that kind of stuff and the right way of approaching it to call attention to that kind of stuff that, you know, you hope will change things. Because you really have to have somebody who, it's true of in every area, someone who's willing to say, nope, that is not okay. To hold people accountable, to be willing to speak up, not be afraid of the consequences, to have the courage to just say, this is not right. You can't hurt me. There's nothing you can do to harm me. You go after me all you want. So, you know, hopefully that will change the culture in Floyd. It's just going to take time.
Did you see any, like, figures like that who would be intolerant of that behavior when you were going through law school and
no.
trying to apply for judge, being a judge?
Well, you know, what I can honestly say is in spite of the challenges, the isolation, the loneliness, I mean, I'm somebody who can really honestly say that being gay didn't keep me from doing anything I wanted to do. Towards the end of my career, I mean, I became a judge in spite of the fact that I was gay. Everybody knew I was gay. Towards the end of my career, there was one time when I received a phone call from someone at the General Assembly. So judges, at my level of court, you have to be reappointed every 6 years. And so every 6 years, you go through a process of you're either a judge or you're not. Customarily, you continue to be a judge unless you do something really stupid. I mean, you have to make a big mistake. Just before my last reappointment, there was a woman in Virginia Beach, a black woman, lesbian, who was at a level of court higher than mine, and she was not reappointed to the bench. And it was historic. I mean, it was really unusual for that to happen. And they said it was because of inappropriate sexual relationship, sexual harassment, I think is what they called it, between her and one of her employees. You know, I don't know what the facts really were. But I was scared when that happened. My reappointment was coming up. And I actually got a phone call from someone at the General Assembly, a friend, who said, I'm just giving you a heads up. There is somebody who is wanting to target you when your reappointment comes up because you're a lesbian. And it was a man who, he was a delegate in the Richmond area. He was very anti-gay. He was in a very staunch Republican conservative district, and he was openly, publicly targeting gay people. And what he did in his campaign, even whoever was running against him, received a huge financial donation from a very successful gay businessman in Richmond. And he, you know, attacked him for doing this as if it was a terrible thing. And so it was the same time that a good friend of mine was running for governor. And so I was really focused on Tim's election, and it never occurred to me that this man would lose his election. Never occurred to me, because he was in a conservative district. So the elections were in November, and my reappointment process was going to start in January, and he lost re-election. And so that was it for me. I mean, whatever he was intending to do to me publicly in my reappointment never happened. But it was, you know, whoa. You know, what do you do? And it was just, you know, a turning point for me professionally, too, that, and for Richmond, it was like, yeah, wow, somebody lost re-election because of an anti-gay platform.
Wow.
How great is that?
Wow. And so, would you say, I mean, obviously the nation as a whole, the whole stance of sexuality and has changed a lot over the years. But
yeah.
Would you say Southwestern Virginia and Floyd, you know, where you flip-flop, would you say that they have changed a lot from when you were?
I wouldn't. It's not old Floyd that's really changing. It's new people coming to Floyd that are bringing a different perspective. There are some old-timers, you know, some people who have been there for a long time who, you know, I don't want to, you don't want to create this sort of stereotype for anybody that, you know, everybody in Southwest Virginia is this conservative, you know, but it is a Bible Belt. You know, there are a lot of conservative Christian denominations there. And I think slowly by, you know, this is why I think it, for me, my individual choice is to be as open as I can be, anywhere that I can be it, because there are people who just think they don't know anyone. You know, oh, they have this, they have their own stereotypes of gay people, and I don't fit it. And so as there's more openness, I think there's greater, one of my least favorite words, but I think there's greater tolerance. I don't know how accepting, I don't know how accepting people are of me in many of the circles I go in, but they're tolerating it. They're not pushing back. I have no idea what they say behind closed doors, and I don't really care. My hairdresser is a woman who has been in Floyd County her whole life, generations. You know, she's amazing and progressive, and she's like the most creative hair. You wouldn't know it from my hair. I'm getting a haircut tomorrow. I shaved my head. My head was shaved because I was in Nepal last year, and so it's just, I'm just letting it go crazy. And I talked to Chrissy. I'm going to tell Chrissy tomorrow I'm getting married. And she'll be great. She'll be so excited for you, Kim. Now, I don't have the slightest idea what she really thinks. You know? Does she really think, wow, that's, you know, I don't know. But I don't care. So that's part of it, is I just don't care. I don't care if people accept me. I don't care, you know. I really don't want to be targeted. I don't want to be humiliated. I don't want to be harassed. But people, you know, in Floyd are polite. They don't like you. They're just going to stay away from you. They're not going to say to your face, oh, that's, you're going to hell. Some of them might. If you give them a chance, like, let's have a conversation about, you know, theology around homosexuality. And Jim never does that. He never tries to have the theology conversation. He could. It's just, you know, introduce its neighbors. I'm your neighbor. My neighbor happens to be a lesbian. And it's like everybody, who, do you really talk to your heterosexual neighbors and friends about their heterosexuality? You don't. I mean, you do your business together. You do what you need to do. And, you know, so maybe Floyd's changing a little bit because there are more visible gay people there. They're tolerant. The new people are accepting.
You mentioned you went to Nepal last year.
Can you
tell us about that a little bit?
Yeah, I went with a clinic. It was transformative. It's been a little more than a year. It was the fall of 2014.
Yes.
I was gone. I was in India for a couple of weeks ahead of time, and then in Nepal for more than a month, and in the most remote region of Nepal, walking with a group of doctors. And I was obviously not a doctor, so volunteering at the clinics to patient control and things like that. And it was incredible, unbelievably beautiful and difficult. And, you know, we're blessed. Even our housing projects are better than anything that people have in third world countries. So.
Did it, like, give you some perspective on the whole world entirely?
Or? Yeah, actually, and one of the most powerful pieces of it really was around technology for me, and the way it we're out of balance with it. I didn't have access to anything. I mean, there's no cell phones. There's no electricity still in parts of Nepal, in the most remote regions, and there's a way that people are able to be present to each other that's not, doesn't have the distraction. Of course, there's, you know, it's a luxury, and it makes life easier. You know, they would love to have all the technology that we have for ease, and I didn't miss it for 1 minute. And movement, you know, people there walk everywhere. They're in the entire time I was in the northwest portion of Nepal, there's not a single motorized vehicle, not one. There are no motorized vehicles. And so it's this ancient, it was really like stepping back in time hundreds of years before cars, and, you know, people are walking. It's, we were on an ancient trade route to Tibet, which is China. It's hard for me to call it China now, but, and, you know, they're doing it the same way. Donkeys, sacks of flour and rice, and going up, walking up to China, Tibet, to trade for salt and things. So, you know, there's a simplicity, you know, and it's easy to romanticize that when you have the conveniences of, but it was really hard for me to get in a car when I got back. It's like, you know, why do we, you know, there are places I can walk in my, not many, but there are places I could walk. And for a while I walked to meetings, like five miles from my house. It's like, it's nothing. You know, we walked twice that much every day. You know, so we're spoiled. And there's a disconnection from the planet that happens when you do that. So I'd go back in a minute.
Yeah.
And highly recommend it to anyone. Travel. So travel. Travel, travel, go places, see things while you can.
Expand horizons.
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you said you had done some traveling before in Nepal. Would you say that that gave you perspective?
Absolutely.
Whole?
Absolutely. India, Nepal. I've done a lot of traveling. You know, it educates you just in a different kind of way, you know. As I say to you, there's a commonness. You realize that there's really not a lot of differences among us. I don't care where you go. I was one of the poorest, it's really the poorest place on earth next to Africa, in terms of, you know, food, and I mean, for the winter months it's hard for them to survive. And their humanity, their humor, their maybe local customs that are different, you know, and certainly there are, but the things we want and need and desire in terms of connection, and it's all the same. And that's been surprising to me, actually, no matter where you go.
Yeah.
There's a McDonald's everywhere. Kind of. In the bigger cities, anyway.
And so you traveled domestically, too, earlier mm-hmm. on in the 70s or 80s?
Mm-hmm. I did a lot of traveling. I did more traveling in the 90s.
Okay, yeah.
All over the U.S.
And you said, like, you your friends would seek out, like, gay-safe places.
Yeah.
Can you, like, describe to me, like, what that would be like to try to find one of those?
Oh, yeah, you go on. Oh, actually, I wouldn't go online then, but mm-hmm. travel books.
Yeah.
Word of mouth. I mean, there were hot spots. San Francisco, Key West were two of the primary ones. Fort Lauderdale has for men. Actually, it was more male geared, but Key West and San Francisco were the two big places. New York... But not so much, actually. You know, New York's more of a cosmopolitan city, but not really known for being welcoming in that way. So, yeah, you just talk to each other. Where did you have a good experience? And, you know, there are magazines. Mm-hmm. You know, Advocate's been around for a long time. And there are all kinds of underground publications for a long time that you just know because you go to a gay bar and they're there. Local stuff where you can find travel ads. And there were people... Even then, you know, trying to court the population.
So would you say that these places sort of link together the nation in sexuality, if that makes sense? Like, would you say that they kind of...
They were safe spaces.
Brought people together.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and Washington, D.C., even DuPont Circle is an example. You know, gay bookstores. Where you could find a lot of information. And, you know, people go where there are people like them.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least where they feel safe being who they are. And I don't do that anymore. I mean, you know, certainly, well, now that you don't have to think about where to get married. I mean, it was a little bit difficult for me, you know, like, I would really love to be legally married in Virginia, you know, just... But what difference does it make? We're going to be legally married, you know. Part of me wanted to be that first person, because I'm sure nobody's done it, who walked into the Floyd County Circuit Court and said, I'd like a marriage license.
It's exciting.
Yeah. Yes. And then, you know, at the other hand, you know, I don't care about being, it doesn't really matter. You know, mm-hmm. we can all do it, and that's the important thing. And now, you know, we don't have to worry about insurance and the stuff that, you know, other people take for granted. That they've been able to do forever. Estate planning is simpler. Now we can worry about other things.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yes. So, okay. So, I mean, would you say, I know we keep talking about traveling, but
sure.
It's sort of an important role, I would say, in terms of shaping you as a person. Would you say that you may have been a different person if you didn't travel, like in terms of acceptance of people? Because when you travel to new places, you're meeting new people. And so would you say that that's helped you become more accepting of not only yourself, but others?
Yeah, I would. I mean, I think if I had been born and raised in Floyd County and had never been out of the county, and there's still plenty of people who do that, and I didn't see that, oh, wow, there are places, there are gay bookstores, there, you know, in the Castro District in San Francisco, there's a movie theater that shows gay films. I mean, if I didn't know that there were places beyond my small world, you know, yeah, I think it would have really been harder for me to see that there's a broader world out here that's not narrow. It's bigger than where I am. And that's part of the recognizing the, you know, that it's not everywhere. It's not this way everywhere. You know, even in India, I was so surprised to see routinely men walking down the street holding hands, you know, very affectionate and close. They weren't homosexual. They just accepted the closeness among men, and there's fine. You know, you learn from seeing that there are things that are done differently in different places, even though the humanity is the same, and it's expansive. You know, it gives you a sense of hope, and it's like going to a museum in some ways, you know, where you're exposed to different ways of doing things. It helps you come out of yourself, I think. Just see the world as being bigger than my small little pocket. Especially, you know, for people who have had a limited worldview experience. There's a tendency we have to think our experience is either unique or that there's nobody else who's felt this way. You know, it's the power of story, and especially when people are willing to tell difficult stories, is that someone else can read that or listen to that and understand that I thought I was alone. I didn't think anybody in the world could possibly feel this way because they hadn't been exposed or people hadn't been willing to tell the truth about their hard things, you know?
So now, I know you said, to use the term, you know, little pocket of the world.
Yeah.
What would you say for people who can't get out of their little pocket? How would you recommend that they sort of reach out to the world outside of the pocket?
There are lots of ways to do that because of technology. You know, there's a virtual world of company online, and I think that's one of the great things about it. You know, Jim's communicating with, you know, Quakers in Uganda, and connecting and talking, and you know, there are a lot of ways to connect with people who share a perspective. You just have to have the willingness, you know. I have this interesting, one of the really fascinating experience hiking. Anita and I were hiking at the Cascades. I don't know if you know where that is.
Mm-hmm.
It's spectacularly beautiful. We're hiking, and we, it was about a year and a half ago, and we encountered a man on the trail who was very effeminate, but he was a man, and he just befriended us. He was lonely, you could tell that. And was talking to us, and, you know, he was talking, I thought he was a gay man because he was so effeminate, and talking about, you know, it was hard to meet women. And I'm thinking, honey, you don't have to pretend with me. You don't have to talk that you're trying to meet women. You know, we're gay. We're lesbians. We're together. No need to put up this charade for us. When we got to the top of the Cascades, he finally made it. He sat down. He told us his story, and he's actually a hermaphrodite. And really difficult. And for me, it was mind-blowing because I thought, how could anyone discriminate against someone who actually has an extra chromosome, right? I mean, there's pros and cons to that whole thing. Is there something genetic in me that makes me a lesbian? But this human actually had an extra chromosome and had qualities of male-female, has had a miserable existence, really identifies as a female, That's where Danny's gender association is, but wants to be with women. So there's this weird, you know, he just doesn't fall into the category of anything that makes sense, right? And she is like completely isolated and lonely. We've tried to connect with her on any number of occasions. We've invited her to PFLAG events. We've got Jim and Anita and I have taken her to the movies once. She's very attractive, very smart, and won't step outside of the box. I mean, we had invited her to a meeting she said she was going to come to where there were other transgender people in Floyd. And there's, because of her own history, she has a mindset that she's not going to find anyone who's okay with her. And she's wrong. She's wrong. But that fear and whatever, you know, has happened to kind of hold her down her whole life is keeping her from connecting with the world that is there. How do you do? I mean, you can't force someone to do that. And so you have to be willing. If you really want to make the connections, you have to have the courage to say, I'm going to try this. But, you know, she's had a lot of bad experiences where people have made fun of her, and, you know, her own sense of herself is so damaged. You have to believe in yourself enough to know I'm worthy. I'm worth having friends. I'm worth having good friends. And you can find that in this world. If you're willing to do it and put forth the effort, you know, there's no reason anymore why someone should be alone. There's really not. But you just have to have someone say that to you, maybe, or somewhere see that that's the case. It's not easy for some folks.
Can you point to a moment in your life where you felt that way, that you came to that realization that you are worthy of not being alone?
You know, that wasn't ever my issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know whether it was because I was an athlete.
Yeah.
So at the same time that I was an outsider, I was always an insider because I had a team and I was good at it. So I always had something that that gave me a sense of belonging. So I'm very fortunate, you know, that I think is one of the hardest struggles that people have is thinking, you know, I'm okay. I don't care what the world's, I mean, you know, it just didn't take me, that's just not the struggle that I had. Mine was more of, because of my formative experiences, with relationships, whatever you want to call them, that screwed me up so much that what I didn't understand is, you know, how to make a commitment in a relationship. You know, what is long-term fidelity and loyalty, and not to say that I was a bad person, but I just didn't understand. That was really my work and learning to be, not learning to be, because not everybody's wired for, you know, long-term relationship. It's fine. But I am wired for that. I just didn't know how to do it. Those are the things I had to deal with. Fears of abandonment. You know, somebody's going to leave in a minute because relationships were just taken from me. Any relationship I had, if my mother found out about it, it was over. No closure, no conversation, and they were fucked up relationships to begin with. And then when they weren't, when they were, you know, with people my own age and whatever, it just, there was no way to have that happen. We just couldn't have a long-term relationship without a tremendous amount of secrecy, struggle, and I just didn't know how to do it. That's been my work, not worthiness individually, but how to heal my own internal wounds. We all have them. How to do my own healing so that I didn't get in my own way, sabotage things without really knowing it. It's maybe more than you wanted to hear, but
it's valuable.
So would you say that that's sort of not an issue, but would you say that that's something that might be contingent with your generation?
Maybe, and I think it's an issue, you know, it strikes me as being worth saying this to, and this is not just for being gay. It's harder when you're different, but I think, you know, what happened for me because of the formative experiences that I had in my, you know, those tender years of experimentation, what happened for me is that I didn't, even though I felt I was okay, I didn't really have a solid sense of myself as an individual separate from anything else.
Right.
Just me. I'm fine all by myself. I don't need a relationship. I really did. I needed relationships. I didn't know it. But things got torn away from me, and relationship became the most important thing to me because of those formative experiences. And I think that happens a lot. You know, it's hard enough as an adolescent, but when you're a gay or lesbian person, that tendency to be defined by or to feel like you have to have someone anchor you. You know, I'm my better half, my other half, there ain't no other or better half for me. I've done my work. I'm a solid person in myself. Whatever wounds that I had that were there, whatever hurts and pains and traumas that I had, and there were plenty, I've taken care of my own business, and I can stand completely alone. In fact, I love being alone. I have, you know, a lot of interests. I went to Nepal without my partner. You know, it's icing on the cake, and a lot of folks don't see that's the, you know, a relationship is really not to complement or fix or and when you're lonely, of course you're looking for that. You know, you think if only I met the right person. You know, Danny, the hermaphrodite person I was talking about, it's not about meeting the right person. It's about meeting yourself first and being completely whole and solid in that. And then the person you meet is going to be a whole different kind of relationship. It's not going to be this codependent, fearful, needy kind of thing. It's, hey, we're two great people. I'm perfectly fine by myself, but this is even better to have someone to share life with. So I think there is the risk of that when you're a marginalized kind of, when you live in that way and you just, you know, I craved community. I'm a pack animal by nature anyway. But I just craved community, you know, of people, like-minded people where I could, you know, be myself and share life with. I think it, just generally speaking, it's a challenge for a lot of people to be okay all by themselves and to have a life that is separate from a love interest or a distraction in that way, or, you know. And, you know, I'm sure that when there's that much loss and you want, if this is a thing my stepdaughter has said this, I just want someone, I just want to be the most important thing to someone. I mean, we can all identify with that, right? You have to be the most important thing to yourself. You really can't expect a relation, you know. Of course, you want your partner to think you're fantastic and wonderful. Why would you be with someone who doesn't think that? But if you're looking for someone to give you that primary sense of belonging, you're missing something. And that's where the openness and the support that so many gay and lesbian people have now really helps to have healthier relationships, you know. It's been interesting to me. I've wondered, you know, why, you know, I've had three significant long-term relationships in my life. This is my third. And there's a lot of movement in, you know, if I look in the community in Richmond, you know, people have kind of, you know, there are very few relationships, you know, two of my best friends have been together for almost 30 years. That's very unusual. And why is that? Is it any more or less than heterosexuals? I don't know what the research shows. It seems to me like it's more. And why? Is it, I mean, you know, I don't know the answer to that, but I think part of it is the, you know, marriage is really a communal event. Mm-hmm. I mean, historically, I wouldn't go there, but as it's really about property. But, you know, when you think of the support that heterosexual couples have, you know. I mean, there's a social network that really doesn't want them to get divorced, that wants them to stay together. There are services, their friends would, you know. And there's marriage. There's marriage. It's not a small thing to get married, and it's a hard thing to get divorced. You know, a lot of it's a contract. It's a promise. It's an agreement. And we didn't have that. Mm-hmm. Does that matter? I mean, has that created less stability in relationship? You know, I don't know.
So, I mean, that's valuable lesson to be learned. And do you think, I guess sort of my final question, do you think, it seems like you came into yourself before you came into sort of the relationship realm, and do you think that that has shaped the way that you handle your relationships now by coming into yourself first?
Absolutely. And then do you definitely. Think, it took me too many years. I hope it doesn't take either one of you that long. No, I was, you know, but I had a lot of trauma. I had a lot of trauma in my childhood, some of which you haven't heard about. And so, you know, yeah, absolutely. You know, make sure that you know yourself first and that you're solid alone, that you have interests and things that thrill you, that you love to do alone with your friends. Any relationship that you have that comes from that place is going to be better than one that comes from, I feel so much better about myself when I'm with him, or I feel so much better about myself when I'm with her, or, you know, what happens if I lose him or her? Whatever, you'll be fine. If you have that core sense of yourself, you know, relationship, not to say there's not heartbreak, but fundamental to any good relationship, I think, or any healthy living is a strong sense of worthiness and value alone. Your home is in yourself. Mm-hmm. My home was not in myself. Until my 50s, late 40s maybe, but 50s. There's nothing that can rock you. When your happiness doesn't depend on anything outside of you, there's nothing that can rock you. Not it to the core. I mean, you know, obviously there are things that happen that are difficult and challenging, but not in that way of can't be okay without it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So as we're wrapping up, do you have anything else that you want to have memorialized in the story that you just want to express for us to keep on record?
Just my happiness and gratitude to all of those people who have laid the foundation for the world being better for me, who have had the courage to be open and vocal and, you know, even radically so, which might not be comfortable for me, you know, have made the world okay for me, and that, you know, how happy I am for most of the younger generation that it's been easier. And to, you know, understand where you've come from, understand who your ancestors are. It's part of what you're doing.
Well, thank you so much.
Thanks for sharing your story.
Thank you.